You're part of the Country Hour with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Local Radio WA.
Very shortly, making our way to the Northern Goldfields, catching up with our Rural and Resources reporter, Tara de Landgraft. She's been on the road all this week. She's usually based in Esperance, so she's been clocking up a few kilometres this week, getting out and about north of Kalgoorlie, having a look around, seeing how the season is shaping up. It's been a particularly dry summer, and there wasn't a lot of feed around and a lot of camels, feral camels, coming into pastoral stations. But it seems to have changed around in just the last month. There's been some good rainfall. There's some feed popping up through the ground. And even the camels seem to have disappeared. So we'll talk to Tara and some of the locals a little later in our program. In the meantime, jump on our WA Country Hour Facebook page and flick through the photo album that she's put together. A selfie there of Tara and some of the crew from the ABC Goldfields Esperance region, and also some of the characters that she's been meeting along the way as well. On the Country Hour, 12 past 12. Well, Rural Lobby Group, the Pastoralists and Graziers Association, says it would never commit pastoralists to fund upfront 50% of the cost to construct the Murchison Regional Vermin Cell, a fence to keep out wild dogs. A group of shires in the Murchison region have requested just over $4.5 million from the WA government through royalties for regions to build part of the 480-kilometre vermin-proof fence. Livestock losses due to wild dog attacks are estimated to cost WA's pastoral industry around $7 million a year and have forced many stations to destock their sheep and goats. Minister for Regional Development, Terry Redman, says he made it clear to pastoralists via the PGA that if pastoralists can come up with half of the funding required to get the project off the ground, it would strengthen the business case. President of the PGA, Tony Seabrook, says there's no way the PGA would agree to those terms. Now, Tony, you've obviously had a meeting with the minister and discussed this proposal at some point. Can you clarify what happened at the meeting?
Yeah, Belinda, for sure. It was just an almost off-the-record discussion to update both of us, both the association and the minister, of how the new lease arrangements were falling into place and what was happening. And that was the reason why we got together. And there was a bit of time left over to discuss other things, and this issue of the fence came up. And this is something that the PGA have been pressing for vigorously in every forum possible for a long time. And the minister just indicated that because of a shortage of funds, that the government was a bit strapped, and that it would make it easier for him to prosecute the case if there was a contribution from those members or those pastors that were actually going to be within that enclosure. Now, he just made that comment. It was an offhand comment. It was not a full statement. We didn't discuss it, and the PGA certainly did not agree on behalf of any of our members that this was the way forward.
Is that the perception from your members and other pastoralists, that you have agreed to this upfront 50% payment of the costs of the fence?
Well, on the back of the article in the paper, I could understand why some people might feel that the PGA actually stepped up and agreed to this. But it's not our role to in any way make those sorts of calls or decisions. We're there to represent the interests of our members to the very best of our ability. And we certainly did not give any undertaking whatsoever that we would, on behalf of our members, step up to make a contribution at the level that the minister indicates.
Well, just before coming on air, I did call the minister's office just to clarify, and the spokesperson from the office did make it clear that it was just a suggestion about the 50%, that the upfront 50% payment of the cost.
Okay, so Belinda, we are in exactly the same place. It was just a suggestion, and we are just trying to head off any perception out in the bush that we have in any way stepped up and entered negotiations on behalf of either our members or those pastors that are within that area that aren't members to make this level of commitment. What we can't get our heads around now is that there were clear undertakings given and a clear understanding of the implications and the requirement for this fence a number of years ago. And it's interesting that if you want to do something, it happens instantly. If you want a football stadium, look, that's happening. It's happening in a flash. It's just the government wanted to do it. What we've got a situation here is the government doesn't really want to do this. And because of a shortage of cash, they're being very careful with where the money gets spent. and they're just looking for any excuse. And when I read the comments there in the Weekly of all the reasons why, I'm just thinking, you know, this is just a government looking for any excuse to put this off for as long as possible or not make the contribution they originally promised.
It was only a few weeks ago we were speaking with Senator Dean Smith, and he was suggesting that, calling on Minister Terry Redmond to take urgent action and put an end to the bureaucratic pettiness. Is that how you'd sum
up
what's going on?
That's exactly how we see it. There's bureaucratic pettiness there. And you know, just to put a little thing on the table first, they say this is royalties for regions. It makes it sound as though the government in Perth are giving money to the regions. These are royalties from regions. This is royalties that were collected from regions. And to make it seem as though it's a charity coming from government to the regions is way out of kilter from where I see this as being. But at the end of the day, we need to work out some way of controlling wild dogs. And the people that are going to be within that cell-fenced area are going to be part of a very large experiment to work out whether if you shut the dogs out and then bait and shoot aggressively, you can get them out of the system and then go back to what these properties were originally meant to do, which is run stock profitably.
Well, if that's the big difference, if this fence is going to make such a big difference, why not have pastoralists put up the 50% upfront costs?
Belinda, some of these people have been doing it unbelievably tough for such a long time. You know, the climatically, droughts, it's tough. On the news last night, I just heard them say Australia's become the highest cost of living country in the world. We're trying to produce the products we produce in the highest cost of production country in the world. They don't have the money. You know, there are massive obligations there for property maintenance, education, and some sort of lifestyle. And I just admire them so much that they're still prepared to hang in there and tough it out and take on responsibilities like the Shire President, like councillors. The amount of effort that Ashley Dowden's put into the project so far, absolutely astonishing. And he's got a business to run. These people are not paid bureaucrats with nothing to do. They're trying to survive in a very difficult circumstance.
And been calling for this wild dog fence for, well, a number of years now. What's been happening with the wild dog situation in the meantime while you're trying to get an answer?
Look, the wild dog problem throughout Australia, and it's now clearly recognised both at state and federal levels, is not the wild dog problem that existed 20 or 30 years ago. It's massively different. They're bigger, they breed more often, there are numbers out there, they are creating far more grief than they ever did before. And they were always seen as a small stock animal, vermin, and now they're attacking cattle. Now, this issue is only in the developmental stages of being dealt with, and if fencing this area off and trying to eradicate them is part of a long-term plan to control them and get them out of the system, it just needs to be proceeded with. It's not a lot of money when you consider the amount of money being thrown around the place in other areas.
Well, my information is that this proposal for the wild dog fence in the Murchison has not been formally presented to Minister Redmond at this stage. And my understanding is that it's with the Midwest Development Commission. They're reworking the business case with the Shire of Mount Magnet to come up with a final product before it actually lands on Mr. Redmond's desk. It is taking some time, isn't it?
Well, the good governance would be coming from the other end of this, coming from bureaucracy, coming from a place where there are plenty of staff and there are resources to determine what is the best way forward and to make it happen, not to throw it back on a group of people who are battling to survive, working unbelievably long hours, and say, you guys have to present the business case. Now, government should be looking at this as a massive problem that they need to be part of the solution to and participating aggressively in getting everything in place to make this happen.
Tony Seabrook, good to talk to you.
Linda, my word.
Tony Seabrook is the president of Rural Lobby Group, the Pastoralists and Graziers Association. 20 past 12, you can share your wild dog story with us on the Country Hour today on text 0448 922 604. 0448 922 604. Heading further north now, where some very angry farmers in the Kimberley's Ord Valley are pretty upset with the news that the state government wants to significantly cut their water allocations. WA's Department of Water plans to cut over a third of water allocated for Ord Stage 1 farms, stating the water is not currently being used. But farmers are saying a use-it-or-lose-it approach doesn't allow for future development. Tyne McConnon has been following the story this morning for us. Tyne, why are farmers so worried about water that they're not actually using?
Well, look, Belinda, it's not just that they're not using this water. It's about the whole point that this is a water agreement that's been made between the state government and farmers in 1995, and they signed off on the amount of water that they could use, and that amount of water allowed them to have the flexibility to grow anything. So that was the certainty that you're going to have at this time 335,000 gigalitres of water a year, which is a lot of water, but that was secured for them. And that's the word I have been hearing a lot this morning when speaking to people, is that we have secure water, or we had secured water, and this is what's helped investment in the Ord and in this region, because water security is something which you don't see very often across Australia. The fact that the government is now moving in, and the Department of Water here is moving in and saying we are going to change it without any agreement from the farmers in the region is of real concern. But it also, Belinda, comes down to the fact that they are saying we haven't used it for the last couple of years, but many years ago, a few years ago, when we had sugar in the Ord, we were using all this water. We could have used more. And as we have heard of late, sugar is a potential crop for the Ord in the future, with the development at Ord Stage 2, which may see the sugar industry revived up in this area. And farmers have said to me that I'll consider growing sugar again, but they need that extra water. I spoke to one farmer this morning, and he's also the chairman from the Ord Irrigation Cooperative, David Menzel. He is particularly angry.
Well, we haven't used it for the last few years. We were definitely using it back when the sugar industry was running, but we've sort of got various reasons why that's not running. But the idea is that the entitlement is committed to Stage 1 to ensure the flexibility to grow any likely crops into the future. So that gives that absolute certainty, especially in a resource where we divert about 3% of the full capacity of the water resource, and we're actually only using about 17% of the diversion due to the hydro. So it really gets down to the business model that was agreed to by the state and the local irrigators when the, you know, the white elephant, the failed irrigation scheme, was offloaded as a liability to the government. The growers agreed that they could take it on and take that risk, and the trade-off was that we required a level of certainty, which was the 335 gigalitre water entitlement, and that would allow us the security and certainty and flexibility to cope with whatever crops might be likely to be grown into the future. So we can't argue we're not using the water today, but we certainly are working very hard to develop the region and get industry to a scale and be able to use that water into the future. So it's really, that's really our cash in the bank. That's what gives us our underpinning security and sustainability.
So that water security is one of the reasons why people have invested in the region. Is that right, Dave?
That's certainly correct. There's plenty of water around the country, but the certainty of it here helps to offset a lot of those increased risks of operating in a pretty harsh environment with some pretty high operating costs. That's our one competitive advantage, is that we have the certainty over water to be able to design industries and businesses around. Look, the state, under its current sort of policies, wants us to agree to reduce it now, and then we can apply for more water when we need it. But if we talk to anyone on the East Coast, that water never comes back. It'll be continued to be allocated, and there'll be all sorts of reasons, but it takes that level of risk to a much higher level.
As David Menzel did mention there is the possibility that farmers under this scheme could apply for more water if they want it. But the reason why farmers aren't okay with that, Belinda, is uncertain. They're saying, in 3 years' time, if I want that water, I might not be able to get it, because this area is becoming developed at a high rate and it looks like it's going to be developed more. Also, the other thing with this is a significant cut. It is one-third of a cut. So the growers at the moment have 335 gigalitres a year. They're saying they want to cut it to 225, so quite a lot for each property.
25 past 12, this is the Country Hour. Tyne McConnon, our Kimberley rural reporter, in the studio with me, and we're talking about the fact that farmers in the Kimberley's Ord Valley are pretty upset today about those plans by the state government to cut those water allocations. As Tyne was just telling us, the proposal to cut over a third of water for Ord Stage 1 farms. Tyne, why do the farmers think it could affect future development in the region?
It comes down to security over water. So when investors are looking at this area, one of the big perks was that it's got water. Obviously, it's got sunshine, which means that you can grow pretty much any crop you want at, you know, in Australia's winter where nowhere else can grow it. But without that security over water, it just means that there's one more hurdle, I guess, one more application that they may have to apply for. As the Ord Irrigation Cooperative put it, it would mean an extra layer of difficulty to attracting new entrants into the market up here. So they're worried that it's going to put people off that the fact that they probably will have to apply for more.
And I guess it's one of those, it takes time, doesn't it? You don't just put in your application and you get it back like in 24 hours or something like that.
Exactly right. And it comes down to the security as well. We're talking here about the state government proposing changes to a water agreement that was made almost 20 years ago between growers and the irrigators up there in the department. And they don't want these changes, but the state government's going, it's going to happen. So that adds another doubt, I guess, to people looking at putting money into that market.
Any comment from the Department of Water today?
Yeah, there definitely has been, Belinda. The Minister for Water, Mia Davies, has rejected the claims that reduction in water could threaten development in the Ord region. She did say in a statement that the cooperative was well aware that it could apply for that additional water if it needed. In addition, she did say the new 10-year licence would allow for more water than had been used in the past decade. Ms Davies did say that since 2008, Ord Irrigation only used less than 200 gigalitres per year, and in 2013 it only used 142 gigalitres. So she's saying we're still giving you more water than you're actually using.
Thanks for that, Tyne. Tyne McConnon, our Kimberley reporter, joining me in the studio today. It's 27 past 12. We'll check in with news headlines very shortly. Before we do that, let's have a look at the grain-growing regions, because as planting for the winter cropping season begins, a marketing blitz is targeting farmers with insurance products. There's been speculation the federal government is considering subsidies to encourage farmers to take up crop insurance as part of the yet-to-be-released agricultural white paper. But with no clarity yet on government support and many grain farmers emerging from dry seasons, I wonder how many can afford the expense of these insurance premiums. Kath McAloon has this report.
Taking on the expense of insuring a crop is proving to be a significant part of farmers' decision-making ahead of winter crop planting. Brett Hosking farms at Quambatook in northern Victoria and heads up the Victorian Farmers Federation's Grains Group.
As farmers, we farm in what is the toughest business climate in the world, and that's the Australian environment. And we know with climate change that things are probably going to get tougher before they get any better. There is that factor moving forward that we need to make some real decisions about how we operate our businesses from a strategic point of view, and multi-peril insurance could be a big part of that.
Further north, Wayne Newton of Queensland Farmer Representative Group AgForce says for grain farmers who didn't harvest a crop last winter because of dry conditions, multi-peril crop insurance is of particular interest.
They're probably one of the groups that are most interested at the moment. People that are under some degree of financial pressure, their balance sheet's probably looking a little bit weaker. Their bank managers probably aren't quite as happy anymore. If they can actually farm some of that risk out, I think a lot of people in the community would be a lot happier.
But Victorian farmer Brett Hosking says while there's interest in multi-peril insurance, there's one big factor stopping many farmers taking it up.
Yeah, the cost is going to be the biggest challenge. If you've suffered significant debt in your business last year, finding those extra dollars to take out an insurance policy for this year is going to be tough.
There's been intense speculation that the federal government's much-anticipated agricultural white paper will include some kind of incentive, be it a subsidy or tax break, to encourage farmers to take up insurance. Earlier this month, Chair of the Coalition's Backbench Agricultural Committee, Dan Tehan, gave an indication the government may be considering an incentive to nudge farmers into insurance as an alternative to drought support. Without a government subsidy in place yet, one of the companies offering insurance has been travelling the country to drum up farmer interest.
we really need to get over 100 growers in the program to make it sustainable for the insurers. Now, we've already got 150 people that have signed up, and we're certainly looking to take a lot more applications over the coming weeks.
Andrew Trotter is CEO of Lativo, the managing agent who offered the first multi-peril insurance product of its type in Australia last year. This week, Lativo announced it secured a new insurance underwriter after splitting with previous underwriter Allianz, who's offering its own crop insurance this year. Mr. Trotter says Lativo has growers from the west to east coast taking up insurance.
They start from Geraldton in the west, and they go all the way to southern Queensland. And it is absolutely essential. When you run a national insurance program like this, if you don't have good geographic spread, you can find yourself very exposed. And a great example would be if you were concentrated in Western Victoria last year, you really would have hurt the program because the season was so bad. But that is why you have to have the geographic spread when you're running a multi-peril-based insurance company.
You've been touring the country talking to farmers about multi-peril insurance. What sort of feedback have you had? Is it something farmers are interested in, or do they need more of an incentive like the one that's been sort of speculated the government might unveil in its agricultural white paper?
Yes, well, look, there is absolutely no doubt that government incentives will always help growers participate in programs. But notwithstanding that, this is a brand new concept for Australian farmers, and therefore it's a really important job for Lativo to get the message out and educate not just the farmers, but the agronomists, the consultants, the bankers and the insurance agents across Australia, because farmers rely heavily on those people around them.
This week, the Bureau of Meteorology has increased its forecast for a likely El Nino to occur this year. Do you have any concerns about what that might mean, I guess, if there are widespread crop failures, and could that lead to big insurance payouts for your company?
There's no doubt about it. El Ninos do basically rate as a lower rainfall period in winter and spring. So just depending on the severity of that, it is likely that there will be some farms and some districts that will run into some production problems this year. And that's the main reason why you do buy insurance, because at this stage of the season, none of us know what the season is going to be. Hence, it only makes common sense to protect your cropping investment and making sure that you don't go backward.
Andrew Trotter of Lativo International, one of the companies offering multi-peril crop insurance. On the Country Hour, 27-1, Rebecca Dollery in the studio with news headlines.
Thanks, Belinda. Western Australia's Premier Colin Barnett has indicated he's close to finalising a deal with the Commonwealth to compensate the state for its falling share of GST revenue. All state and territory treasurers, apart from WA, have written to their federal counterpart, Joe Hockey, saying any solution for WA should be made separate to the GST system. The federal opposition leader, Bill Shorten, says he supports Commonwealth assistance. The United Nations Security Council has been shown video evidence of an apparent chlorine gas attack in Syria last month. The footage shows three children, all under the age of four, who died despite efforts to revive them. A Syrian doctor who treated the victims at a hospital in Idlib province told the closed-door meeting there'd been numerous similar gas attacks in the past month. And the Social Services Minister, Scott Morrison, has called on men to confront each other to address domestic violence. The federal government's announced more than $15 million over 2 years for family violence services. Mr. Morrison says the issue's a national priority and a zero-tolerance approach is needed. Thanks, Belinda. More news at 1.
Thank you, Rebecca. 26-1.
The Country Hour with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Local Radio WA.
I hope you've made our way to our WA Country Hour Facebook page, because there's a great photo album for you to flick through. Have a look through all the people, the places that our reporter Tara de Landgraft has been visiting over the last week. She's been touring around the northern goldfields, catching up with quite a few pastoralists and others in that patch. So check out the photo album on our Facebook page. And we'll talk to Tara very shortly. We'll meet some of the people that she's been speaking to and get a sense of the season as well, because it's been so dry in that patch for quite a long time over the summer period. But some good rains just last month have certainly changed things in that patch. And we'll also check out the wool market just before the news at 1 o'clock. Have a look at the prices that wool growers were taking home this week. First, we're off to the Weather Bureau. Mark Paul has the details today. Mark, how's the weekend shaping up for the Southwest Land Division?
Yeah, good day, Belinda. Basically, we've got a very weak cold front that's going to move over the south of the state later on tonight and into tomorrow morning. It's going to bring fairly widespread areas of drizzle along southern coastal parts during tomorrow, but rainfall totals are going to be very light. We're only expecting 1 to 5 mils, and most parts will probably barely see the 1 millimetre mark. That'll affect all the southern coastal districts, probably creep into the southern goldfields, and then contract into the Eucla by tomorrow evening. Otherwise, the remainder of the southwest land division should be fine. As we go into Sunday, what's left of that very weak cold front will be producing some drizzle in the eastern goldfields, the southern interior and the Eucla, but should clear up during the morning. And then pretty much the southern half of the state should be fine. Monday, a little bit of morning shower activity about the Eucla, but the southwest land division fine. And Tuesday, the whole southern half of the state should actually be fine as large high pressure system dominates the weather chart.
Can you talk us through northern and eastern forecast districts?
Yeah, up in the north is a little bit different. We've got a stationary mid-level trough that's lying literally through the centre of the state, and anywhere to on the northern half is seeing that west-northwesterly flow, which is bringing in quite an area of cloud band and also a little bit of scatter shower and thunderstorm activity. So that's going to persist over the next 4 days. So we're going to see areas of scatter showers and isolated thunderstorms throughout the northern half. Over in the western Pilbara, they're expecting the band to be slightly thicker. So we're expecting areas of rain to develop around the western Pilbara and adjacent parts. We could see some moderate to heavy falls in the western parts of the Pilbara around the Learmonth and to Karratha area, more or less those areas in between Learmonth and Karratha for a Saturday, Sunday and Monday. Situations start to ease by Tuesday, and we should see a clearing trend also through the Kimberley.
Warnings today?
The only warnings are strongly warning, and basically that's for coastal waters from around about Barrow Island to Broome.
Good. Thank you, Mark.
Catch you later.
Let's check those rainfall figures the last 24 hours to 9 o'clock this morning. And nothing to report in the Southwest Land Division, or nothing over 5 mils anyway. Turning our attention to northern and eastern forecast districts, looking at 10 mils and over. Just a couple to get through in the Kimberley, Mount House Eyre 13, and in the Eucla 19. 23 to 1. Shortly we'll catch up with some of the, budding youngsters who might be sort of heading up our cattle and beef and dairy industries anyway in the future. They're learning all the ropes about cattle through some great trainers. We'll head to the southwest to Brunswick shortly to find out more about that. And also some CCTV cameras being installed in all Vietnamese feedlots and abattoirs as part of ensuring animal welfare standards are met. First, though, it's incredible what a difference a good rain makes. After one of the driest summers on record, pastoralists in the northern goldfields are finally enjoying the benefits of last month's rainfall. And they needed it too, because the dry conditions over summer had created a shortage of feed and a plague of camels. Tara de Langraft has been travelling through the northern goldfields this week. Tara, where do we find you today?
Well, Belinda, today I'm in Laverton, which is about 300 kilometres northeast of Kalgoorlie in the Northern Goldfields. And we're at the LLCCA building at the moment. I'm sitting out on the veranda, so it's just tucked off the main street. I've got grass surrounding us at the moment and a few locals driving up and down the street. But the grass, I should say to you, it is very green because there's been quite a bit of rain out here. So it's beautiful being out here and seeing the red dirt meeting that green grass.
Now, everyone that knows you would know that you don't mind a long drive. You put in a few Ks every year as a rural reporter in WA. And you've had another long drive from Esperance to the Northern Goldfields. What have the conditions been like along the way?
Yeah, look, it has been a reasonable drive, about 800 k's from Esperance up to the Northern Goldfields and to Laverton, where I find myself today. And it's been really, really pleasing to see all the way from Esperance. As soon as you sort of head north through that agricultural region, you start to see things getting green. Perhaps that means that spraying's just around the corner, I suppose, for grain growers, those who are wanting to get on top of that green bridge. But the green that little further north, as soon as you hit Norseman and that pastoral country, it means that those summer rains have really come through. And it has been quite a long, dry summer in the goldfields and southern rangelands. So pastoralists around there have really, really needed this rain. And it's come as a steady rain as well. So last year there was a big whack of rain, but unfortunately it meant that there was, it washed out the railway line, all kinds of things. There was a lot of erosion. But The rain this time round has just meant that the whole way up, there's been green pick on the sides of the roads. You're seeing even the cattle on the side of the roads are looking mighty fat at the moment this time of year. It's been a real pleasure to see that that green pick just really, really pick up at this time of year. It's beautiful.
And I take it the pastoralists would be pretty happy with all that rain, Tara.
Yeah, absolutely. As I mentioned, that green pick is something that they've been waiting for some time. And pastoralists I have been speaking to have been certainly very happy with how the season has been going. And I caught up with Paul Axford from Sturt Meadows Station near Leonora, which is about 200 kilometres north of Kalgoorlie. His station's about another 50 kilometres north of that town. He's one of the last private station owners in the region. A lot of the stations are owned by mining companies in the region, but this is a private station that Paul is custodian of, and he's pretty darn pleased with the season and how it started off, that's for sure.
Well, last year we had 8 inches of rain in 2 days, which created a massive flood, and then we had a few minor rains in February, but then basically we had no rain whatsoever until, we'd had a couple of inches of rain over the next 10 months until the end of February this year, when we had 3 inches, 3.5 inches. But the summer was just extremely hot. The winter was extremely frosty and cold. But yeah, it's certainly been a very, very hot summer out here, and I definitely wouldn't want to go through another one like that for a while.
Seems that the weather has been changing over the last few months, and driving up here over the last day, there's been a lot of green pick on the side of the road. Are your cattle starting to fatten up?
Yeah, no, actually things are looking really good. I hope it's not the last rain for the year, but you never know out here. But no, things are looking really good. Having this amount of rain and green feed going into winter's really good. But also getting that amount of rain late in the summer is good as well.
So that's Paul Axford there, Bell. He manages Sturt Meadows Station near Leonora. Pretty chuffed with how the season started off.
Certainly sounds like that. You're listening to the Country Hour. I'm talking to Tara de Langraaf, our Esperance Braith's Rural and Resources reporter. But she's out and about, as she often is. She's in the Northern Goldfields, been touring around that region for the last week or so. Now, it's great that the conditions are really working in the pastoralist's favour, Tara, but it does get a bit nippy there at times. Are you rugged up today?
I really needed some fingerless gloves this morning for the Rural and Resources Report, that's for sure. So that was something that I really wish I had brought with me. But it is certainly quite cold here. I've travelled east from Leonora to where I find myself at Laverton. And I'll tell you what, the pastoralists here are pretty happy as well. They've had similar amounts of rainfall, which has been great for them, because over the past couple of months, over summer, they've actually had a big influx of camels into the region. So now that that rain has, come, those camels have dissipated a little into the desert.
So those camels have all gone now, disappeared, the ones that were causing all the trouble.
Yeah, look, it seems that way. I've certainly been out with some pastoralists, and we haven't been able to actually lay our eyes on any, which is great news, because they were putting a lot of pressure on infrastructure in the pastoral regions, especially on the water infrastructure. So it's great news that those camels have headed back out into the desert regions, and it also means that there won't be an aerial cull that was touted earlier this year. So at this stage, there isn't any need for that. But speaking to a pastoralist who's also the Shire President here at Laverton, Pat Hill, he manages Mount Weld Station. He's cautiously optimistic that they're not going to come back, but he says that if they do, he'll be ready for them.
We roughly had about 500 of those on the property at one time, and they congregate on about 8 waters on Mount Weld Station. Between them and the cattle, it's a big drain on the waters and the country that we've got down there.
So they've gone now. You're obviously pretty pleased about that.
Yeah.
Are you worried that they might come back, though, because if they've done it now?
Yeah, well, see, a lot of the bulk of the camels that were down there, they will, now that they've gone out, once the water runs out in the desert again, they will come back, because they know the water, of course. And when they do come back, well, hopefully we'll be a bit prepared next time for them. We had a meeting in Leonora there a couple of weeks ago now, and had quite a few people attend that, and a lot of initiatives, and it's basically a workshop on what we can do if the same thing happens again. The quick response would be to do a culling program on them, But obviously you've got issues with that, with carcasses and, you know, feeding the wild dogs. And also your cattle have got the risk of getting botulism because they do chew on the carcasses once they deteriorate. So that's a problem in itself. But, you know, we had good discussions about working together with other shires to the north and south of us and pastoral stations that are fringing on the eastern boundary or the vacant crown land. And that's the biggest problem, trying to get the government to do some sort of a monitoring program and keep the pastoralists informed as to when these big mobs are coming in so that we can get some sort of a response group to them.
So that's Pat Hill there from Mount Weld Station, Bell, talking about pastoralists getting together and setting up basically a rapid response group in case the camels come back.
Well, you've been touring around the region for roughly the last week. Are you heading back south today?
I am heading back south, so this afternoon heading back to Kalgoorlie and then over the weekend popping into the Eastern Wheatbelt on my way back to Esperance. Of course, the Eastern Wheatbelt around that Meriden region have had an absolute cracker start to the grain growing season, so I'm catching up with some people in that part of the world. But I have popped a heap of photos of this week's journey up on our Facebook page, Belle, so anybody can head there and have a look.
That's great. Yeah, I just had a flick through those photos, actually, Tara. So there's the standard selfie of you and the crew and a few others of the characters that you've met along the way as well. So I've really been enjoying looking at those photos. Safe travels and catch you next week.
Thanks, Belle.
Tara de Landgraaft having a good time catching up with the locals in the northern goldfields this week, 13 to 1. CCTV cameras will be installed in all Vietnamese feedlots and abattoirs handling Australian cattle as part of a major new push by industry to ensure animal welfare standards are met. The introduction of cameras is one of six new standards that have been agreed upon by exporters and Vietnamese importers. Matt Brann has this report.
The live cattle trade to Vietnam has grown quickly. A few years ago, the market imported just 2,000 animals. Last year, it became Australia's second biggest customer for live cattle, taking over 180,000 head. But this quick boom has not been without its problems. Cattle have been leaking out of some of the supply chains and ending up in areas of Vietnam where they are often treated inhumanely. Alison Penfold says the leakage from some supply chains is putting the entire trade at risk and something needs to be done.
We don't support leakage. And we want to address it. We're just not going to let this run. We've got to get on and find a means to show those supply chains we mean business. They want Australian cattle. They've got to meet the standards and stick by them. If they don't, they're out.
Alison Penfold says exporters and importers have just agreed on a new set of standards, which includes rules to have dedicated animal welfare officers in all feedlots and abattoirs and for them to have access to all areas. There's new standards to improve traceability, standards on the equipment required at each site, and the big one, which is a world first for the live export industry, importers have agreed to put CCTV cameras in all abattoirs and feedlots.
We've already got about 35 cameras operating already. That was an initiative of Wellard into their supply chains. And the decision was that we would then put the remainder. We're looking, you know, there's over around 80 odd facilities we need to capture. And so what we're currently putting together is a program to enable that to happen with funding coming from industry resources to support exporters put in those CCTVs.
Alison Penfold says if importers breach any of these new standards or if cattle are found to be leaking out of their supply chains, then that importer will be suspended and its supply cut off.
Essentially, if it is a significant welfare breach, exporters have agreed that they'll all support the suspension of that facility. That means that there'll be no new cattle sent to that facility. No other exporter can come in and try and make a commercial relationship with a player that's been suspended by an importer.
How long's the suspension?
Well, look, the suspension is in serious welfare instances, 6 months. It could be longer.
Some importers have already been suspended. Is that correct?
There has been, suspensions already been put in place for importers and facilities. Again, you know, we're serious about getting this right.
How bad has the leakage been, Alison Penfold? Because reading between the lines, it sounds like a significant number of Australian cattle have leaked out of supply chains over the last 12 months.
Look, it's not the numbers; it's the fact that leakage is a problem. It's simply that we don't support leakage.
Oh, I'm sure we've got a lot of listeners though keen to know if the industry does have an idea of numbers. There were around 180,000 head exported to Vietnam last year. How bad is the leakage? Has the industry got an idea of how many animals actually fell out of the supply chain?
Look, no. I mean, this is the issue for us. That we don't think it's a huge percentage, but any percentage is not good enough for us.
Are we talking thousands, though?
I can't give you a solid number.
Yeah.
Potentially, it could be thousands. But the fact of the matter is,
I guess that's an issue in itself that the industry doesn't know.
And that's what we're trying, by putting in things like CCTVs and trying to get consistency across supply chains to have these very direct, frank discussions with importers. We are, trying to arrest this problem.
The rollout of CCTV cameras will start soon. The question remains on who will actually monitor the footage. Alison Penfold says a decision is yet to be made.
Matt Brown with that report. In a statement from the RSPCA, it's welcomed the move to CCTV cameras as long as it goes hand in hand with regular monitoring to check for incidents of animal cruelty. It says cameras do not replace the need for comprehensive staff training and good stockmanship. The RSPCA wants exporters to make the vision from CCTV cameras available to anyone on request and is urging the government to seriously consider rolling out this requirement in SCAS-approved abattoirs in all markets. Now, there's more on this story online on our website. Just put ABC Rural in your search engine, which I've just done, and the story comes up. Number one story on the ABC's Rural homepage. This is the Country Hour, 8 to 1. We'll check in with the wool market details before the 1 o'clock news today, and some good news for wool growers this week. The Eastern Market Indicator up 24 cents, and here in the West, a similar story, the Western Market Indicator up 20 cents. We'll get those details very soon. Now, you know what they say, start 'em young. Well, that certainly seems to be the philosophy at the WA Youth Cattle Handlers Camp, which is on in Brunswick in the southwest this week. Students from around the state are taking part in the camp to learn about how the beef and dairy cattle industries work and also how to show the animals as well. Bridget Fitzgerald ventured to Brunswick yesterday to capture some of the action.
It's a bit of a chaotic and confused scene here at the Brunswick Showgrounds, where about 105 to 25-year-old students are trying to get together to organise a few games. Now, what they're doing is taking a break from what they're really here for, which is the Junior Cattle Handling Camp. It goes for 4 days. It's always in the second week of the Easter holidays. And Dairy Section Coordinator Michael Rose says the camp is the right balance of learning and fun.
So we go right through from getting your animals ready before they enter the show ring, clipping, washing, painting their nails, feeding, and then we try and have a bit of fun as well with a few games, but then also try and do some educational things like feeding on farm, getting heifers into calf, and all, some practical things about what actually makes not just a good show cow, but a good functional beef or dairy cow, so right across the board.
Mm-hmm. And where do the students come from?
All over the state. We get a great support from a lot of the ag colleges, so from Esperance, they've brought a busload of kids up, Morrill Ag down here, Harvey Ag, Denmark Ag, so a lot from different parts of the state. Bindoon Ag, really great supporters as well, but then farmers from everywhere, from Mushay right down to Albany as well, so from all over the cattle producing parts. Unfortunately, no Pilbara kids yet, but we'll hopefully get that one day.
You might not have the space that the Pilbara kids are used to down here.
No, that's right. They're probably not. They're probably showing cattle isn't their focus up there either. So, yeah.
And what are you hoping that the students can learn that's outside what they might be learning on farm or at an ag college?
Oh, look, I think showing cattle now is really a hobby, and it just adds that different element to breeding cattle. You know, farmers are very focused on breeding cattle for certain markets and whatnot, and showing for stud people and even for commercial producers, it's just that bit of a hobby, and whether that encourages kids to go on with farming or not, probably another matter, but generally have a bit of fun and try and pass on the knowledge we've gained. Hopefully we get students that will go on and compete at a higher level and work for show teams. Showing in WA is probably dying a bit. We don't get as many cattle as we used to at the Royal or Brunswick or or certain country shows. So trying to revive that a bit. But at the end of the day, it's all about having a bit of fun with some animals.
And there's definitely precedent for success at this camp. 17-year-old camp veteran Kelly Manning just took out the national prize for dairy cattle handling at the Sydney Royal Show.
The FCAS National Paraders Final in Sydney.
And so how long have you been coming along to this camp?
About 5 years.
And what do you like about it?
Great atmosphere, good people, you learn heaps, get insights into the industries, both beef and dairy.
And what kind of things do you think you possibly could have learned here to take away to your national final recently?
Everything to do with the dairy side, because I live on a beef farm, so all the leading, the knowledge of preparation, the clipping and stuff like that. Trying to become my passion now, right, really good people to get along with. You learn heaps, see all different types of animals, opens your eye.
Do you think that there's a real kind of future for it if you really enjoy that kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, WA is pretty small, but with all the kids coming up through it now, I reckon it might stay alive.
Apart from a few experienced elders, there's a whole lot of youngsters here who are very keen to learn and who are also just a little bit excited to make a few new friends.
Hello.
What's your name?
Heath.
And Heath, have you been along to this camp before?
No.
How old are you?
I'm 11.
And what are you liking about it so far?
Well, it's really nice, like they explain it to you, and we had the best leader. She's called Flick and she's really, really nice.
And what has she been teaching you?
She's been teaching us, she taught me an easy way how to tie a quick release knot. Just then they taught us how to judge a dairy cow better. Mm-hmm. So that's what I like as well.
What was your name?
Thomas Spencer.
And where are you from, Thomas?
Bullsbrook. The cattle people are really nice people. They're just a lovely environment to be in and I just enjoy it, yeah.
And what do you like about it? Have you learned a few new things?
Yeah, we learned how to judge cattle this morning and also just techniques to make the cattle feel comfortable around you. To just keep calm, and because the cow can feel your calmness and you need to keep calm to keep them calm.
A little moo there in agreement, perhaps, for the very well-spoken Thomas Spencer there, ending that report from Bridget Fitzgerald at the WA Youth Cattle Handlers Camp in Brunswick. A couple of minutes to one. Let's talk wool now, and some good news for wool growers this week. The Eastern Market Indicator was up 24 cents to close at 11.30 cents a kilogram clean. Here in the West, the Western Market Indicator also up 20 cents to finish at 11.68 cents a kilogram clean. Tim Burgess is with us to run through the details. Sounds like a good week, Tim.
Yes, very good week right across the board. Just to give you some figures, nationally, we offered 54,230 barrels, of which we sold 52,460 and passed in 3.3%. Some of the major buyers, Tech Wool Trading, China Tex, Fox and Lily, TNU, PJ Morris, Mordiano and Lempriere. When we look at some of the finer details in Fremantle this week, we offered 12,727 bales, of which we passed in 5.3%. Looking at some of the individual microns, 18 micron finished at 12.90, which was up 50 cents clean. 19 finished at 12.60, which was up 40. 20 micron was 12.15, and that was a gain of 25 for the week. And also 21 followed up with finishing on 11.95, and that was up 25 cents clean. And also 22 finished at 11.65, and that was plus 5. Looking at some of the skirtings, well, they were firm to probably in sellers' favour. Very good, strong representation there. And, of course, lock slams and clutchings just continue on their merry way and were very sought after. Next week, we got 46,426 bales nationally next week, of which we'll have 9,771 bales in Fremantle.
So is the feeling we're going to keep going in this direction, up as far as the prices are concerned?
I would suggest going into next week at least we're looking at a farm to a supported market for sure next week.
All right, well, we'll check in with you this time next week. Thanks so much for those details, Tim.
Yep, thank you.
Tim Burgess running through the details of this week's wool market. Great to talk to you today. Enjoy your weekend, and we'll kick it all off again next week on Monday. News time, 1 o'clock.